Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is August 27th in the Western Hemisphere and August 28th in the Eastern Hemisphere, where we have Michael Every in Singapore, returning guest, and Ira Harris is in the United States here in the Western Hemisphere. Michael is global strategist at Rabobank Singapore, where he analyzes major developments and key thematic trends. His research is frequently quoted in financial media, and he's a regular conference keynote speaker. Michael joined Rabobank in 2013 and has been in the research field for almost 25 years, based in many different locations. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great, I thought we'd begin. Michael, you had a piece, The Power of the Powerless, a Rabobank piece, just recently out. If you wanted to elaborate on that in more detail, what it's about, what the key messages are.
Sure. I mean, first of all, it's kind of, I guess, typical of a lot of the stuff I put out that it's based on a pun in the title. I can't resist a good dad joke, but one that tries to make a serious comment, looking at, you know, what's happening in markets and where possible, drawing in analogies and parallels with other disciplines. So the title was, as you said, The Powell, as in J. Powell, of the Powerless. And that's a pun, for those who are aware of it, on a very famous piece of 20th century political literature called The Power of the Powerless, The Power of the Powerless by Václav Havel, who then was a intellectual dissident in former Czechoslovakia. And of course, he later became president and a very good president of that new country. And what he was arguing when he wrote it originally back in 1978, and when it first came out, it had to be published in what they used to call samizdat, which is basically underground dissident self-publishing. I mean, today we have the internet and, you know, the dark web at the fringes of it. But back then, you know, you had to physically do things yourself, however you could, and kind of, you know, smuggle them into people's pockets in Eastern Europe. And he was basically describing a system which was completely all-encompassing, the former Soviet bloc, suffocating, and based on a rather bizarre ideology, which was kind of a secular religion, which was internally inconsistent, and everyone had to nod and go along with, and which created its own reality. And everyone was forced to go along with that reality. And he argued that the only power you had to resist it was if, in his analogy, you were a greengrocer in a state-run grocer's, and one day the local Communist Party chairman or chairwoman gave you a sign that said, "Workers of the world unite," rather than putting it in the window and being basically just part of the system as an individual, in just echoing that meme, echoing that message, and even passively just going along with it. If you took the simple act of just not putting that up in your window and everyone acted similarly, gradually, at the margin, the system would start to show its underlying weakness, and that we all have a responsibility individually for saying, "I'm not going along with this. I don't agree with what I see around me. It may be all pervasive and it may be very hard to push back at. I don't have to go out on the streets and shout. I don't have to get shot. I don't have to do X, Y, Z. I just don't have to passively go along with it." So that was the power of the powerless. And you may wonder, what's the parallel here? Well, I was drawing the parallel that the Fed in particular, you know, that our modern international financial system with the Fed at the center, also is an all-pervasive system in nearly every corner of the global financial market and the global economy. And yet the Fed itself also is a secular religion with a completely inconsistent, incoherent ideology, which pans left one minute and right the next and completely contradicts itself all the time. And yet no one is ever brave enough to actually, or very few are brave enough to actually point out the inconsistencies in it. But most of your average portfolio managers just go along with it, even though they're ostensibly well-educated, very intelligent, you know, trying to prudently invest everyone's money. Now, I don't manage money. I want to make that abundantly clear. This was just a, you know, generic helicopter overview rather than any kind of investment advice. So whereas in Harville's pamphlet, you had a greengrocer having a sign in the window saying, "Workers of the world unite." Now you have portfolio managers with an email just saying, "Rate cuts!" Exclamation point. Capital letters. Now, we are going to get an easing of monetary policy, and we can talk about that in more detail. But the enthusiasm which the same people were shouting that, or are now shouting this in emails, having been wrong in 2021, 2022, 2023, and all the way so far in 2024, and just disastrously, epically wrong, shows that they are not trying to do what markets are supposed to do, free markets are supposed to do, which is to not act like a cog in a giant post-totalitarian system, which is basically what Harville called it, but actually try and find true price discovery and actually try and think, what's the real value of things? What do I really think? And I do think, as I concluded, that markets will find lots of avenues to push back against the Fed, because it's trying to give us this fantastic view, which our Fed watcher, who's got a great track record, called totally lacking in humility and totally evident in hubris. And the market will find ways to push back against them. And the simple conclusion in market terms was this: if the Fed is trying to get everyone to scream rate cuts, and it's promising lots of rate cuts, and the Fed has understood reality wrong, and we still have inflation in the system, which I fear we do, and it has to backtrack and raise rates again, well, that's going to be an absolute epic mess. That's going to be a kind of end of regime as well as end of cycle in many respects. The policy framework that we'll have to put forward after that is going to shatter many illusions. But equally, if the Fed are wrong and they have to cut all the way back to zero again, which, you know, some people screaming rate cuts would love to see, that doesn't cure any problems either. That's going to absolutely just create 10 times more problems than it solves, right the way across the whole nexus of the global economy and global markets. And so we're at a very, very delicate point here. And I think it behooves all of us in markets to try and be objective, to think as individuals, to try and look at where things are inherently and logically contradictory, rather than just echoing really simplistic financial media headlines and sending out emails saying, rate cuts. So there you go. That was the piece in a nutshell. Thank you for giving me the platform to explain it.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, great. All these twists and turns. What are your thoughts, Ira, on the historical analogies?
Well, I'm certainly in that camp, and I'm not one. So when I read the Rabobank piece last night, and Michael and I will laugh because sometimes I send him a note, because I've now conversed with, well, we did a podcast when, I'm not sure how long, but 8-9 months, I don't know, it's been a while, but I got a good dose of what Michael's about and how erudite, and as much as the word is problematic at times, this one it holds, because when it comes to global financial history, Michael is erudite. And I can say that with great respect, because him and I have already changed some books, and you know, there's people out there who really bring this stuff to the fore, Origi and certainly Burdell, but Michael's so well versed in them. And working for a well-known Dutch bank who is so instrumental in the financing of global commodities, which gives them a nice bird's eye seat, by the way, because as the money flows, they're seeing it. And I don't mean that in any nefarious or conspiratorial way. That's just the way the world works. So they do get to see it, and he makes the point. And you know, Richard, anybody who's listened to these podcasts, I mean, I was on with Bill Fleckenstein, which was great, and Daniel Lecaille recently. And I beat on the Fed too. So I really enjoyed the piece, because the Fed wants to accept no responsibility for where we're at. But yet they are the most powerful entity in the global financial system. So much so that when the ECB statement comes out, you almost think that they just plagiarize each other. The Japanese is the same. The for the most part, the RBNZ is the same. They're all the same because they're all following a step. Although we have seen a recent break because the Bank of Canada has cut, the Swiss National Bank has cut, the ECB has actually cut, the Japanese raised. So we are seeing a little bit of break, but the language, I mean, the language from Jackson Hole, it's an international group that's there, and they're all reading from the same hymnal, so to speak. So we do see it, and therefore Michael's point about the Fed is more than well taken. And now, you know, I was a big proponent and said it very vociferously in the podcast with Daniel LeCaille in July 22nd, 21st, whatever it was, that I thought the Fed was going to cut 50 basis points at the July meeting on July 31st. And if I thought they had a good opportunity because number one, you know, I was citing the SOM rule. Now it's interesting. Now the SOM rule is in effect, and Claudia SOM wants to walk away from it and now offer all these ifs, ands, or buts. But everybody a year ago was talking about the beauty of the SOM rule when Claudia SOM was going out on her own. Now, but I thought that gave them a window because for the Fed to cut in September puts them right in the middle of the political presidential campaign. Had they cut July 31st, and I thought 50 basis points, and I know Dudley came a few days after that, not that he was listening to me, he wasn't. He came to his own volition. And I know Zoltan Pozsar put out a piece too about a 50 basis point cut in July, but they didn't do that. But I thought it would have been the wise decision, and they could have done it by, we're taking out an insurance policy. We know that the labor market is beginning to soften. And we want to remove ourselves from the politics. Therefore, we'll cut 50 basis points. And they had another way to do it, which is the R star, which John Williams talks about. And of course, Isabella Schnabel wrote a piece back in April or May about R star and its. She called it a philosophical construct, of course. But in a world that the central banks, you know, again, 2 years ago, there was $18 trillion of notional negative sovereign debt. So the central banks of the world have created this monstrosity of leverage. And we saw it in 23 when, you know, Silicon Valley Bank blew up, followed by one of the street's favorite, which was First Republic. So you've had those. They still exist out there. So why not have cut with, because I make real yields at about, I think of the real yields using overnight funds, using their inflation data, because that's all I have to use, is probably 2.2, 2.3, which is historically pretty comfortably in towards the high side. So why not cut and say, we're getting out of the way. And if the employment, so we've already taken, we've actually gotten ahead of it. But now they're chasing it. So will they cut? Everybody, you know, and I think Michael's language is beautiful. Everybody on Wall Street, right? Every analyst starts Fed cuts. Is it going to be 25 or 50? Doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me because now they're chasing it anyway, depending on, now we're going to see the August jobs data. We're at 4.3 by the most recent of July. So the points are well taken, and this is where it puts us. And the Fed, they should not be doing a victory lap. And I think as Michael talked about, Powell was doing a victory lap. I don't see the victory lap. I don't see the victory because if they get this wrong, with the massive amount of leverage that exists in the world, they're going to have to pump all this liquidity into the system anyway, which we saw them do, right? In March of 2023, we had the bank term funding program. That was a minimum of a trillion promised, and we didn't know, and it lasted a year and they pulled it back. But it's liquidity, it's quantitative easing by any other name, and this puts us in this difficult situation. So I think this is a good jumping off point to see where we're going to go from there. But I think in historic, there is no victory lap to be taken here. I'm not a Powell fan. I think he has tried, and I think he was dealt a very difficult hand, but he hasn't helped himself. So this is where we're at, and now we're chasing again. So let's see where we're going to chase to.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I can't help thinking of, and I'm going to misquote it now because it's early in the morning here, but that quote from the ancient world where we get the term Pyrrhic victory from, that, you know, one more victory like this will ruin us utterly. that if this is a victory lap, I don't want to see defeat. Just a couple of individual points that I want to, you know, come back at you with. I'll come back at you on, Ira. Well, I agree with what you said. First one, and in no particular order, I think in terms of the data in the US, what a mess. What a mess. Because I've had one kind of slogan that I've been trying to get to catch on in markets, and sadly it hasn't. I keep plugging it. It's not catching on, which is that DM, developed markets, equals EM, emerging markets. And I think intellectually more and more people understand that. But unfortunately, as I said, that T-shirt that I want to sell isn't selling, which is that we like to think, when you look at the US in particular, that you're one kind of entity, and emerging markets, where I spent most of my professional life and adult life living and working, are something very different. But increasingly, they're not. If you look at the quality of the data you're getting out of the US now, it's poor. It's really, really poor. If you look at the distortions to the data, particularly, you were talking about the labor market. No one knows what's going on with the US labor market. How large is your labor force? We don't even know. Is it the official number? Is it 5 million larger over the last 4 years? Is it 10? Is it 12? I've heard 15. I've heard people saying 20 million people more. Now, I don't know, and I'm not trying to make a political point there in that. No. But it is a political point, because we don't even have anyone trying to estimate it, because it's too taboo for some people to discuss. And yet the Fed, I'm supposed to believe, haven't known this conversation is happening, even if it wasn't in the mainstream media until the last few weeks. I can assure you on social media, it's been going on vociferously for a long time. I've been in that loop since the beginning, just listening. So are you telling me, not you, but is the market trying to tell me the Fed didn't understand that this dynamic might be happening in the labor market? They didn't know that the BLS were going to revise down benchmark payrolls, as they always do. Again, on social media, the 1 million figure was flying around since January or February, that would loom. And then just in the last few minutes, I saw other research, I won't say from whom, arguing that the 818,000 downward benchmark that we got, which has helped push the Fed towards this easing, actually itself isn't realistic, because they think almost maybe 60% of that figure, if not more, is again accounted for by jobs that are going to illegal immigrants, and so, or undocumented Americans, depending on how you want to be political in describing them. I'm being facetious as a Brit, but there seems to be a lot of, you know, vigorous disagreement on terms of how to even categorize it, which is part of the issue. So where are the data? What is the US labor force size? Is it strengthening or weakening? Okay, we can see it's weakening, but how badly, we simply don't know. So that's the second point. And then two more quick ones. The Fed itself, with the timing, it seems to me, yes, they've definitely made a mistake. I'm with you completely. But again, to think that the Fed or any central bank isn't political is a nice little illusion or lack of reality that we want to believe within this power of the powerless, or Powell of the powerless, that they are completely apolitical technocrats. Now, that's never been the case anywhere. They have strong political views as individuals. They have biases. And not only that, they're appointed by presidents or different bodies in other countries who also have their inherent or you know, obvious biases. And our Fed watcher, Philippe, I'm going to plug him again. His call's been fantastic. He's been saying September since very early this year, when the rest of the market was just screaming January, February, March, April. He's saying, no, September. And he's only had to tweak his call a tiny little bit to accelerate it slightly rather than change it. He put out a piece recently which didn't get the credit it deserved in one very clever thing. He started to list the current voting FOMC members and the ones that are rotating in. And he didn't put H for hawk and D for dove, as your mainstream, you know, vanilla Wall Street analysis will do. He put in R for Republican and D for Democrat.
Who is this?
Philippe Murray. He's our Fed research.
You got right. Okay.
Yeah. And anyone who can read the original text of the Powell of the Powerless, there's a link to Philippe's work at the top of it in the hyperlink. So please do have a look. And you know, he wasn't really banging the drum heavily on that point, but in doing so, he was making a key point, which is, do you think, okay, that everyone on the Fed thinks exactly the same way about rates? No. Or the economy? No. But would all of them be willing to go and work as an advisor to the current Democratic administration like Brainard has? No. Would they be prepared to go and be Treasury Secretary the way that Yellen has? No, some of them wouldn't. Not for a Democrat. They might for a Republican. So you clearly have inherent bias in the system there. And does that mean that some of them might even have a preference for who wins the election? Probably. Are they going to be overt about that? No. Could it maybe at the margin influence timing? What, do we live in a real world or do we live in a fantasy? I think we live in a real world. So I don't know if it has played into it. I'm not saying it does, but it's indicative of the mess we're in, not just in terms of the actual mess, but the inability to describe the mess, that conversation isn't happening more overtly in more different Wall Street shops to recognize we are in an emerging market with overtly political players, with overtly political goals. And we have to be when we see what a big mess we're in.
And let me, if I can, Richard, let me just top this off. Because we're not being political in this discussion. We're just analyzing what exists. And I know, but I'll take it further because I've been so critical of this. So when you look at the Biden, what I call the Biden Four, who are the governors, not the president, not the district presidents, because honestly, I really don't care about the district presidents because the governors have a lot more power because they can supersede and there can be meetings of the governors without the districts where they can make a decision about cutting quantitative tightening without the full board. The governors can meet. In fact, there was a piece that came out today that prior to the meeting, there were two districts, New York and Chicago, that voted to cut the discount rate prior to the meeting. I don't know if you saw that today, two of them. So I look at the Biden Four. I look at Lisa Cook. I look at Kugler, Philip Jefferson. Who's the fourth one I'm missing? Well, certainly Goolsbee is, you know, he was in the Obama administration and he votes, but there's another governor. And look at how many ties to Kamala Harris's father, who is an econ professor at Stanford and Berkeley.
And by the way, and I don't say this in any kind of pejorative sense, because I'm a Brit, and I have argued previously on this channel, I believe, as well as many others, that we should read as many different schools of economic and political thought as possible to get a broad view. But her father was, I believe, a Marxist.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I'm actually familiar. I went back and read some of her dad's stuff because, first of all, he was at the University of Wisconsin teaching, and I came out of the University of Wisconsin graduate school, and I really had an emphasis on political economy. He was gone by then. But, you know, I come out of a Marxist background, so that's not a pejorative.
So do I, by the way. We
have that in common. I know. I know. And that brings us to these points about understanding the debt situation. That's not a pejorative. That is a comment of great respect on my part, by the way, because the Marxists.
Mine too.
I know. I know from talking to you. So because the Marxists with the Austrians saw the coming, quote unquote, third world loan problems. They're the ones who, you know, Gabriel Allman and his wife, one after another, we can go. They were the ones who saw what was going to unfold in the late 70s. And how do I know that? When I went looking for a job at banks in Chicago when I left graduate school, and they said, well, what do you bring to the table? I said, well, I'm here to explain to you how your third world loan portfolios are going to blow up. And they laughed at me. And I said, you'll see. And as I like to tell the story, one of my finest moments as a trader was when Continental Bank, which was a huge bank in Chicago, well, a big bank in Chicago, and they and their third world loan portfolio blew them up. I actually had TED spreads on. I was long T-bills and short euro dollars. And I said, I'm going to play golf because I do not want to ruin this trade. And I did. I walked out and it was one of the best trades that I ever had. And I said, okay, we're even. Because you didn't hire me, I interviewed there and they told me, oh no, these loans are great. So, I mean, the fact, but I say that with great respect out of the Marxist school. And his, I've read a few, more than a few of his papers, and actually quite a lot I still agree with, because they were well thought out. And that's not, but it does put them in a leaning way.
It does. And if I may use that as a platform to kind of look forward a little bit here. First of all, personally looking back, I too have been laughed at openly, within this profession, by people who have never read Marx or who know who he is and think they understand him without actually having analyzed his work, and Lenin too, by the way. It's important to get both of them together, and make similar big picture calls on that basis, which just seemed ludicrous at the time. I mean, pat you on the head, go and sit in the corner, you're an idiot. Like, yeah. The global financial crisis. That was obvious from any Marxist perspective. You could see the global financial crisis was going to occur, you know, and completely ignored in calling it. Of course, I couldn't call what month and what year it was going to happen, but I was, you know, right. A little bit early, but it's better than, you know, being completely wiped out and having to be saved by QE. Anyway, on that, linking the two points, depending, therefore, not just in terms of this rate cutting cycle, but let's presume that the Fed's got it wrong rather than right. Okay, let's because if they've got it right, rates are going to go down a little bit, equities are going to go up. It's a fairly safe story. Any mainstream Wall Street analyst who doesn't read broadly is going to call that right if they walk that knife's edge correctly, okay? But if they don't, we either have two scenarios, as I said. One of them is that inflation is in the system because, as I've said many times in the past few years, we live in a world in which Marx is being talked about more and more, even in US universities openly, and Lenin is being acted out around us. You know, you see political violence being put in place at gunpoint to try and achieve certain aims. That's inflationary on both fronts, and it can't be anything but. And so if the Fed is wrong and inflation is embedded in the global system, at least to different degrees because of this Marxist / Leninist structural shift, if they cut too early, you're going to see the dollar tank. You're going to see commodities go through the roof. You're going to see, you know, every silly asset class, every piece of junk go through the roof as well, which is already starting to happen. Of course, gold's going to go through the roof, crypto, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're then going to have to tighten again, at which point all the people who are saying stay alive till 25 are not going to be staying alive. And basically the entire fantasy that we can go back to the model that we had up until COVID of just lower for longer forever and just financial froth being the economy, that dies if they have to tighten again. Now, on the other hand, if they get it wrong, as I said, and they have to really, really, really cut, well, then all this Marxist-Leninist domestic political turmoil, international political turmoil, absolutely happens on steroids. Because if you think we've got protectionism happening now, and we do. Canada's just raised tariffs on Chinese EVs to 100% on Chinese steel. Mexico's talking about doing it. So that's the USMCA. America will have to match that. Otherwise, Canada and Mexico are more protectionist than the US, which is insane. Really? Europe's talking about doing it, although on a lower scale. Indonesia wants to do it. Thailand's talking about doing it. Turkey's talking about doing it. Brazil's just done it. Everyone's going to get much more protectionist. And if you're really looking at a domestic collapse, if you are, you are going to raise tariffs to ring fence that new liquidity to make sure it's my money for my people. That's going to happen. So we're going to have global protectionism and the whole globalization model fractures. What we've seen so far is merely a warm-up where trade flows are being redirected. The US is buying more from Vietnam, for example. China is exporting more to Vietnam. Vietnam's the middleman. That's also true for other countries. That's just one physical example. But in this example I'm talking about, a few years down the line, potentially, Vietnam is using the US dollar. China isn't using the US dollar, hypothetically. And right. You have a completely fragmented global payment and clearing system like you had in the 1930s. which is, of course, a pretty worrying parallel. So that's the real thing that worries me in terms of the big picture trade people aren't seeing. And then to bring that back to the Fed, if I may, that's one angle of it. And the other one, which is related to it, is if we're going to have a flood of liquidity, either because the Fed is just going to cut now anyway, and that will be leveraged up, or because they fear we are heading for a deeper downturn, and or they just want to try and help out the next president, whoever that is, or they're leaned on by the next president, and that can easily happen. You either change the board to be more easily leaned on, or you just lean on them. Trump's openly talking about that. So that's a threat from either administration, potentially. Where does that liquidity go? And let me just spend 30 seconds to make the key point, and then I'd like to open it up. I've made one other really big call over the past couple of years, and that's this. If the paradigm breaks, it isn't just going to be about low rates or high rates or loose fiscal or tight fiscal. You're going to need all of them in combination, because you're going to have to look at your society in a Leninist environment where you've got war around you, gray zone economic attacks, you know, non-state actors trying to destabilize supply chains like the Houthis with the Suez Canal. And you're going to have to think, is it really helpful to have zero interest rates if everyone puts it into crypto or into funding a Silicon Valley company that makes cats look like dogs on your phone so you can entertain yourself at lunch? Look, my cat looks like my dog. Or is it going to be more useful to have that liquidity going into rebuilding physical supply chains and technology with a defense spin-off? And is it more useful to give money to everybody, or is it more useful to channel money to people who are going to use it productively to do something for the USA Inc.? And that is an entirely political choice. There is no way, Jose, that you can have a Fed which can use the usual mechanism of here's not enough liquidity, here's too much liquidity. You need to give ample liquidity fiscally and monetarily to people who are doing useful things, and you need to restrict liquidity monetarily and fiscally to people who are doing dumb things. But the choice of what is dumb and what's useful is a political one.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And within this protectionist type of view, Michael, do you see it evolving through a multipolar type of world, different regions, jurisdictions, or is it just every country for themselves?
Well, if we really look at the nitty gritty of who trades with who or whom, in which product categories, along the value chain, and where it ultimately ends up, and it's not difficult to do that work, but it's really, really boring because you can't download it from Bloomberg unless someone's done a nice graphic for you. And even then, you don't know their methodology. And you can't download it from any of the, you know, the Excel-based data sources, which most economists and analysts rely on. You have to go to really boring websites like UNCTAD, for example, which I've been using for decades. And you've got to physically copy and paste across sheet after sheet after sheet and manually put it together. So you can see, yeah, along the value chain, who's selling what to whom, what value is being added, and where does it move on to? It's really, really boring input-output table work. But if you get there and you do that, and I have, then you can see that multipolarity in the way that people like to think of it, like you're going to have a renminbi block or a ruble block or whatever, it's almost impossible to achieve. Because even though, let's call them the BRICS or the axis of upheaval, whatever terminology we want to use, if you color in the map globally, wow, they have a lot of territory. Wow, they have a lot of GDP. Wow, they have a lot of people. And in some cases, they have a lot of technology. But if you put it all together, they don't actually trade intra-block very much at all. And what you do see is raw materials go to China, China adds value, sells it back to them, which, by the way, is a Marxist trading analogy, which is not good for the country producing the raw material. Then you go further and further into debt and never move up the value chain. But China actually still sells far more to the West. So it's very hard to come up with any realistic coupling for any of them that works as an integrated block if we are then a separate block doing something else. So I don't see multipolarity working like that. What I can see happening is that from a hermit kingdom or a purely defensive perspective, you will see what's already happening, which is bilateral barter between countries in the other camp, which is priced in dollars mentally. Like, I've got $100 worth of X, you're going to sell me $100 worth of Y, we're just going to swap them, and no dollars are going to change hands. That's already happening. Mm-hmm. And that will be scaled up at the margin. And at the same time, China is trying to use the digital renminbi as an upstream commodity trading platform or trade financing platform to try and get countries like Brazil, the Middle East, Africa, to start selling them raw commodities into their supply chain and just giving them renminbi for it. And they'll provide very, very generous liquidity. It's effectively vendor financing, and all the risk is on their book. But the problem is still that China's going to do that, and maybe eventually it's getting raw materials in renminbi, but it's still having to sell them to us, the West, the dollars. And therefore, the system is still not completely coherent internally. So I think the more likely option is you get basically China and a key group of economies doing what Russia is trying to do. And even there, it's not working very effectively, which is just saying we can't create an alternative system, but we're just going to opt out of the current one as much as possible. And over time, we hope we gradually build up a nexus which can work. And one last point, what will help them do that is if we have ample liquidity into the wrong areas of the economy. If we just slash rates and have a consumer spending boom, blindly, stupidly, and an asset price boom and a bubble bursting again and more, you know, socioeconomic instability, that can only help the other side, who are trying to build physical supply chains to make things. If we end up in an economy another 20 years from now where we don't make anything, including defense products, and the other side make everything, then even if we have a consumer economy and commodities, which America does and Australia does and Canada does, but no production in the middle, they're going to win by default, because all we've got is a financial economy and raw materials. And they'll have a weak financial economy, weak consumer economy, raw materials, and a big production economy. And Marx, as you know, Ira, is all about productive capital, not fictitious capital.
Richard, where are you going to take us? Because now we're at the point, I think, a jump off point. In fact, Judd sent those charts. Can you put those up?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So, Michael, these are charts from, go ahead, Richard, you say who they're from.
Yeah, I'm going to share my screen. From White Wave Trading Strategies, Judd Hirschberg has put together these charts. And let me just share my screen here so we can go through some of these.
I think if you put up the
here we go.
The commodity charts, which show like the price of soybeans in yuan, the price of corn in yuan, the price of copper in yuan, it'll reflect a lot of what Michael's talking about, because we see it, you know. And again, the Wall Street mindset is, oh, the Chinese are going to just devalue the yuan. I don't see, you know what, as I say over and over again, anybody who's listening to me ad nauseum, I'm much more in alignment and agree, and I respect him immensely, Michael Pettis, who's talked about the significance of the China. If China's going to actually start consuming more, a weak yuan is death to a middle class, because everything becomes more expensive. I mean, you see the Japanese now complaining about it, that the yen was too weak. And what are they running on? The people who are running to become prime minister, those who are actually espousing a stronger yen, because it will help the smaller enterprises and the middle class in Japan, are actually polling better, whatever the polls mean. I mean, I think the election is September 27th. And I've relied on the work of my son, who's really a recognized expert on Japanese politics, and he has really captured this very well, how they've actually shifted. And I think the Chinese yuan, here's the chart, perfect chart to bring up, has mirrored the yen far more than any other currency. They're very aware of the impact of the weak yen. Now, the yuan has been strong on a historical relative basis, but it's been really stable. And now the yuan went from what, 7.30, as the yen has actually strengthened, yuan has gained some strength, but the yen has gained against yuan. So we're at, I'm looking at it right now on my own screen, 20.24 yen to a yuan, which is now, you know, the yen has gained some strength. Mm-hmm. But when we look at this, and then Judd was nice enough to roll up, and we look at soybeans right now in terms of yuan, are fairly, they're at a low level. Can we call that chart up? It's an interesting chart.
Yep, that's one.
There it is. Look at that chart. The price of soybeans. Now, soybeans have gone down against dollars in dollar terms too, but it has not harmed the Chinese whatsoever. In fact, the Chinese are benefiting. And in fact, I don't know where the bottom is going to be in the soybean market, but if my conjecture is right, the Chinese are going to start stockpiling beans from the U.S. soon, because especially with a falling dollar, right? And I think that's our next jump off point, is just about the dollar in general, what we're seeing, because the dollar has made a fairly aggressive 4 or 5% drop in the last month. It's coming down. For those who follow the dollar index, we're approaching the 200-week moving average in the dollar index. Let's see if it'll hold there. I think it comes in around 100.30. We're trading right now 100.64. I don't know if he has that chart up there, but it is worth looking at it. But, and this comes back to your analysis of the Fed, Michael, is that a weaker dollar, which they never talk about, boggles my mind. It boggles my mind that no journalist at the press conference asks, well, are you concerned about when this dollar was too strong? Was that being a drag on the U.S. economy? No questions about it whatsoever. But a weaker dollar, as you pointed out in your wonderful summation, a weaker dollar eases credit conditions globally. Because as you talk about the emerging markets, they're borrowed up to their eyeballs in dollars. So when the dollar was at 110, 109, 108, it was choking the emerging market world. And it was forcing them to keep interest rates higher than they probably would have liked it. Because again, the real yields in the emerging market world, from Brazil to Mexico to some of the African nations, were unbelievably high.
Yeah.
Now, with the dollar coming off, they have room. I'm sorry.
No, not at all. I mean, there are so many angles I want to explore. Let me just start very briefly. Mm-hmm. I think for those who don't necessarily look at the renminbi or the yuan, I think it is important to understand that there's a very clever and simple mechanism at play there, that they have capital control, so you can't really move your money out very easily. It's like the Hotel California. You can enter any time you like, but you can never leave. It's very, very hard. And that actually, even though every traditional non-Michael Pettis analyst will tell you is a terrible way to run a place. Well, yeah, it is. It comes with serious issues, but at the same time, it means that China can print as much money as they want domestically. They don't print it, but you know, their M2 growth is just like an upwards going rocket. It's incredible relative to GDP. But what do they do with all that money? It doesn't create inflation because they put it into supply. So basically, you just keep printing bank loans, which keep building more physical supply and everything, so that you gradually dominate every major industrial sector bit by bit by bit. And then, you know, you're the one with a productive capital supply chain and everyone else has to buy your stuff or prices go up and, you know, you have the whip hand. It's a very, very clever strategy, which the West is too stupid to understand. And it really is. And Wall Street, which is always telling China to get rid of the capital controls, as you know, Michael Pettis argues we should be adopting them. And I can completely see his logic. But so that's the renminbi. I agree with everything you just said in terms of commodities. I would say that our Rabo commodity experts, who I don't have their latest piece on my desk in front of me here, but obviously they have very good, very, very, you know, market-leading views on things like soy. But where it ties in with the way I look at it is twofold. I've been saying for some time now that one part of the US-China clash has been that while the Fed wouldn't talk about the dollar, they were actually quite happy to have high rates because it meant a high dollar, because it was sucking capital out of China. Because even though capital can't leave officially, unofficially, people can always pad the books, you know, over invoice exports, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Imports. There are ways to get money out the door, under invoice and over invoicing exports, imports, et cetera. And that was having a very real effect if you were reading reports from China. And I think the US view was, if they did that, it might be harder for China to keep building aircraft carriers. And, but it's actually not working. That is not helping, because on the consumption side, China has made a very deliberate choice, it would appear, that consumption, we can live without it. What we really, really need is the domestic supply chain, which becomes an international supply chain. So I think that's not going to shift. Now, are the Fed going to give up on that? If they do, as you were saying, and they do cut aggressively, we're already seeing, as you said, the dollar drop. And what's interesting is other economies around the world, which have already cut their rates and have been more dovish than the Fed, are seeing their currencies rise. Everyone is reversing that long dollar. And so you're getting countries that really desperately need a weak currency now to try and get a bit of export growth are actually seeing the currency go up too much. And to me, that suggests that at some point, the likes of the BOC, the likes of the RBNZ in particular, and possibly the ECB, although, you know, there's a lot of structural inflation in Europe, are going to be stuck with this really hard choice where they've got inflation that may be too high, but an economy that's really, really too weak. So they've got stagflation that's far worse than in America. And what are they going to do? And I would imagine they'll probably cut, at which point, yes, the dollar can go down for now, but medium term, it can go back up. And one final little point, just as a segue back to that, because otherwise I know it won't come up again. With the soybeans, who produces them for China? The US and Brazil, yeah. So the US, are you going to sell them in renminbi? Never in a million years.
Right.
Is Brazil going to sell them in renminbi? That is the big geopolitical pivot point. Because almost any agri product that you can name, from cotton to soy, whatever, Brazil can grow it. It's got all the land to do it, and it's often cheaper than anyone else can do it. And the current, you know, president is pretty friendly with China. So were that to happen, head spin, global commodity markets change, the world changes. Because then if the US is going to pressure anybody, let's talk realpolitik for a second. Can the US pressure China directly? It's pretty hard to do it. It's trying, but it's pretty hard. Who could it pressure?
Of course, it's Brazil. Well, exactly. Yes, except that China has been very successful at building those really deep roads into the global south, so to speak.
Literally roads.
Yeah, yes, that's right. But
yeah.
So going back to that's right. So now this is August. And I'm looking, so in stating that case, on August 5th, the data when finally people understood that the carry trade, which was already unwinding, because as you just showed, Richard, on the Mex-Yen, that was a great symbol of the carry trade over the last 2.5 years. It was relentless, really. And you did very well in it, but you started to see it unwind. So on August 5th, which is a magic day, because that was the day when finally everybody woke up and the media said, oh, there's a yen carry trade that's going on. How does this work? And all of a sudden, within 24 hours, they became experts on something. And again, they were chasing it. But on that day, the Brazilian real made a high of 5.82. Since the yen has settled in and the dollar has sold off, I mean, last week we got down to 5.37. So you had almost an 8% appreciation of the real.
Yeah.
Dollar drops.
On that front, by the way, I sometimes get pushback from people, besides the fact they don't like my big picture political view. But even if they do like it, they'll say, so, you know, where's the trade on the back of it? And I always try and tell them, look, there are lots of trades. You just have to disaggregate what I'm saying and put it in bullet point form. And I do that for them. And, you know, a simple one related to what you were just saying is that, okay, yeah, the Brazilian real is going to be a key currency to watch, absolutely. And it is volatile. But more broadly, we have, again, let's use Marxist lenses for a moment, a global economy based on massive, massive structural weaknesses. You know, it's completely unbalanced. You've got massive deficits here and massive surpluses here. You've got the rich here and the poor there. Very simplistic, very true, not going away anywhere. And in the financial markets, on the back of it, you have got trades that are leveraged to the nth degree,
right,
on the back of those imbalances, which are not politically sustainable. At some point, they're going to go. And I said, protectionism in the West is going to be one of them. Brazil will be another pivot point at some point, vis-a-vis China and the US at some point. And then all those leverage trades, whether it's in the agri sector, whether it's in the financial sector, you know, bonds, FX, you can disaggregate them one by one. You will see the kind of epic volatility that we just got in the end. There's a lot more of that to come in our system. And the Fed don't appear to have the foggiest idea of just how much potential volatility there is locked in.
That's so, I'm so glad we got to that point, because again, why should they cut? Because they have to be worried about the leverage in the system, because you're going to pay for it one way or another. Meaning,
but what, the central- but what does the cut do? It increases the leverage. You just, you basically get another incentive the other way.
Right. And they don't, and because as you saw with last year with the banking crisis in Silicon Valley, they didn't let anything correct. There was
SVB is a great point, because again, excuse me for continuing to bang the same few drums, but I think they're good drums, so I want to keep banging them. When I was saying earlier that you're going to have tight and loose monetary policy, and that's a political decision. So when they bailed out SVB, initially, again, I was surrounded by people screaming, rate cuts. And I said, I don't think so. If this thesis I've got is correct, no, what you will have is a continued high interest rate and an acronym, which is, there you go, money for you, but tight borrowing costs for you.
Right.
And we're now moving away from that for a generalized lowering of interest rates. Our house call, by the way, just to be clear, under Philippe again, just to give him one more pat on the back, he thinks the Fed can only cut four times, four 25 basis point moves, if Trump wins. If Harris wins, it's a slightly different story, because then he thinks maybe a couple more. But and he, you know, we don't know exactly what her policies are going to be yet, because she seems to be changing them every couple of hours. But they're not going to be probably as tariffic, if you'll excuse the pun, not as tariffic as Trump. But based on those tariffs, if not the tax cuts, he's saying only four cuts. But if you're surrounded by people saying rate cuts, they're not factoring in the fact that the Fed can keep rates at, say, 4.5, which is some relief. The longer end of the curve will continue to be overexcited and continue to price for more. So that's real easing without them actually doing anything. But everyone who wants to support the dollar, you're still getting that T-bill and chill, as we've been hearing in the market the last 24 hours.
Right.
You still have support for the dollar at the very, very short end in the money market fund side.
Yeah.
And if they need to bail people out, you make a political decision. SVB was important. There you go. Liquidity for you, albeit at a cost, right? It wasn't free money. Next sector, are you important? No acronym for you. Are you important? Acronym for you. So I still think that's a more logical framework to expect. And that's one of the reasons why I was so contemptuous of what Powell said. Because you would think if we're going to start to do that, you might want to start sending the message to people. Why the hell should we have the guardians of the global financial system refusing to tell us what they're actually doing when they claim to be transparent and giving forward guidance? Wouldn't it help to actually reveal what the real game is? We want to see a reindustrialized US. We don't just want to see a low unemployment rate. We'd like to see jobs in the right sectors. You know, we would like to see leverage go down where it can be in these sectors. What's wrong with saying these things? They're entirely consistent with financial stability, low unemployment, and low inflation. Why do we have this generic rate cuts or rate hikes? Why can't we have something more moderate?
Go ahead, Richard, I'm sorry.
I wanted to ask just a question on how does an investor invest in this environment, given all the protectionist and other geopolitical risks? Does the investment process depend upon the investor jurisdiction, where the investor is located? And how do you see that,
well, Michael? Let me make a very quick joke before I give a proper answer, which is okay. Like the old joke, how does a porcupine make love? And the answer is very carefully. And the same thing is true for an investor trying to invest in this particular environment, because you can make absolutely the right call and get the timing wrong, as always in markets, and lose out. But I think the key thing to start looking at, as I tell clients all around the world for the past couple of years, is look at the world map and don't think of it anymore as one giant integrated system. Start to look at it as differentiated systems, the way that it looked like for much of the early 20th century and the 19th century, and start putting that template over things and thinking, okay, so if that system were to start emerging, or that grouping were to start emerging, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what would it mean for my presumption of this company? What does its supply chain look like? Does it get all its products from country X and sell them in country Y? Well, are country X and country Y going to continue trading on the same basis they are? Are the margins going to be squeezed? And we already had a warm up for that during COVID. COVID was the perfect dry run where suddenly you couldn't get X, but you could get Y. The government was giving free money to these people and not helping those people. And you saw credit strains here and the credit spigots opened in other locations. And some goods were ample and some goods were in short supply. Take that template and presume it's permanent.
So let me come in. So, because Michael comes back, this is all going to wind up in a credit, as it always does. The credit will set the world. I mean, that's what, again, when we talk about, that's what the Marxists and the Austrians saw in the 70s, what was happening with the recycling of the petrol money. What happened? The Saudis and OPEC were taking the money, recycling it to Chase and Citibank, and they were making loans to who needed those types of loans? Those who were trying to finance energy imports, right? So they were chasing it. And this is where we're going to be at too, because of, as what Michael talks about, these great imbalances. Now, the greatest imbalance may well be the U.S. debt situation, which also goes, you know, I understand Powell's reticence. He can't get into that discussion because, yes, the Fed is not as apolitical as it wants to believe, but to go and start preaching and hammering about what he calls the unsustainability, when he's willing to go to the edge of the diving platform and put his toes on the edge, and he calls it the unsustainability of the fiscal situation. But that is, and it's a vulnerability for the U.S., I believe.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, this is all okay. Separate discussion. No one likes the picture you see now. I certainly don't. And I'm no longer an Austrian or a Marxist. I just understand how they think. But we all know, and the Fed has already amply demonstrated in recent years, they can just buy the long end. So then there's no such thing as a free lunch. They can continue to finance the deficit for no matter how ridiculous it is forever, but it would be inflationary and the dollar would go down a lot and commodity prices would go up a lot. Now, again, this is where you have to start drawing politics into it. I'm not making any forecast. I don't know what the world will look like in this respect. But you're either going to get some kind of fiscal rebalancing. I mean, Trump, remember, is talking about trying to shift to using tariffs rather than domestic taxes, which is a Hamiltonian shift, which most people on Wall Street can't get their head around. But I understand it. I'm not saying it will work, but I can see the thought process. But in overall terms, whoever's president is either going to have to deal with the deficit or not. And if they don't, the Fed is either going to have to decide, do we let the market punish them? Because eventually they'll be punished, at which point you're going to have, you know, a very steep curve, and the long end in particular is going to get smacked. Or is the Fed going to say, we can't do that because of the debt, at which point we have to step in and buy it. And then it's every other asset you want to sell. And I think gold going up tells you people are thinking about that happening at the margin. It's not a good sign in that respect. But you do have to make a deliberately two-step political call. Will a president deal with it? Yes, no. Will the Fed either be leaned on or of their own volition turn around and say, we'll do something about it? And that can actually happen in ways that you don't expect, because I don't know if you guys look at the Bank of England. I know they're not really, you know, the big player they used to be. But when Liz Truss was prime minister for like 39 days, I forget, 39, 49, it was a less less than the lifespan of a lettuce, because when she became prime minister, a local tabloid newspaper every morning ran a picture of a lettuce with the eyes stuck on it and said, who will last longer, Liz Truss or the lettuce? And it was actually the lettuce that lasted longer. But she, you know, tried to put in place a very, very bold, expansionary tax-cutting budget to go for radical growth at a time when the Fed was doing QT and still hiking. And the Bank of England refused to step in and do anything to lower what was a market panic in gilts. Could they have done it? Absolutely. Did they refuse to do it? Yes. And at the time, again, as a Brit, without any skin in the game, because I live abroad, but as someone, again, who's lived in emerging markets most of his life, I looked at that and I said, that's a coup. And that's a coup by any other name. If the central bank, which is nominally independent, but which we know can buy gilts as much as it wants to, whenever it wants to, when it likes it. For example, if you said the government's going to spend an extra $100 billion for something green, they'd buy them like that. You know they would, and they said they would. Right. But for this tax-cutting budget at that particular moment, no. Gilt yield spike, panic, headlines, Truss is gone. Internal party coup. Now, whether that's for good or bad, not the issue. Just in the last couple of days, again, that story's come back. Truss, obviously, is continuing to say, I was toppled in a coup. No one really wants to talk about it. No one likes to imagine that the central bank can decide itself whether they will or won't act, depending on whether they do or don't like the president or the prime minister. But evidently, when you have that kind of power dynamic in the system, it can happen in that direction too. And you show me the Wall Street analyst again who wants to write about this, when actually this is the reality, and putting up rate cuts in your greengrocer's window or Workers of the World Unite is not going to tell you what's actually going to happen.
No, no, it was such a great point about that. All right, Richard, where are you going to think? Just,
if it's okay, one last question. I know we've been over an hour here, but just wanted to discuss your thoughts if China is investable from a G7 investor point of view, you know, notwithstanding the protectionist trends, as you mentioned, you still have a very historically high trade surplus, right, between that China has with the U.S. So there's a lot of interdependency. Is it safe for an American to buy Hong Kong shares, or could there be a risk of capital controls, exchange controls imposed by the U.S. on that investor? Your thoughts?
Well, remember, when you buy Chinese equities already, you're not actually buying the Chinese equity. You're normally buying something that's held in a different form, in a different location. It's not a pure equity buy the way that it would be in the other jurisdictions. And if you're asking me in black or white, yes or no terms, are there tail risks in some scenarios to an investor of, you know, capital controls or basically markets just being shut down or seizure of assets? Yes. If it's yes, no, then the answer is yes. Does that exist in other jurisdictions? Some of them, yes, but to a much, much lower degree. Now, if you want a two or three steps forward thinking view, profits aren't that high in many sectors in China anyway, because they're looking at productive capital. They're not looking at profits. They're not trying to make more profit per unit. They're trying to make more things to actually push the price of them down, which is good for consumers. Deflation is good for consumers, by the way. We've forgotten that. The whole financial system doesn't like deflation, because it makes it hard to service your debt. Consumers do. They would love a bit of deflation right now, provided they didn't lose their job. But above and beyond that, the long run hope is that they will make money, that eventually you'll get like 100 firms dominating sector X until one or two really take over, or sorry, in sector X until one or two take over. They get global scale, at which point all the monopoly returns go to those firms. At that point, and before we get there, we'll get protectionism. But, I fully expect to see part of protectionism being country after country, which have previously said, we don't want Chinese products, saying, we will have them provided you build the factory in our country and transfer the technology, which is exactly what China did over the last 40 years to everybody else. And if they're traded publicly in your stock exchange, go for it. If you can get like cars, and I'm not going to name any firms because this is not investment advice. This is just a strategic thinking here. I'm not telling people how to invest. But were that to happen, then hypothetically, you would have the opportunity to own equity of car, EV maker ABC, for example, in your own jurisdiction with that technology, with that production platform. And some of them are really, really good products, allegedly, not that I'm an expert on that field at all. So I would say that's probably the better way to play it. And if we get Fed cuts and everyone's just saying, buy all the things, that please don't buy all the things. Please, please try and be a little bit more careful than you're thinking.
That's very interesting. Great, great points. Ira, do you have any final thoughts and any other questions for Michael?
No, it's just, you know, we've come to this point, and it's, again, you asked a question about investability, and I think you have to be very selective when you look around the world, as Michael talks about. You know, if the dollar keeps going down, and China pulls what they did to me during COVID when they were stockpiling, you know, prices dropped, but they won't drop too much farther if the dollar keeps weakening. But China will stockpile. They stockpiled copper. They stockpiled grain. You know, everybody was the Wall Street mantra was, of course, the Chinese in 2021, 2020, were going to devalue the yuan. Why? They were going to try to protect their export markets with a much weaker currency. China went the other way. We saw the yuan go from 7 down to 6.10, and what were they doing? They were using a stronger yuan to stock. They stockpiled everything, copper, iron, and then they started auctioning it to their manufacturers at far lower prices than the rest of the world was buying when copper ran back up over $4.50. They're much better traders than the Japanese have ever been.
Yes, in that respect, they are. And again, through these lenses we keep talking about, I think objectively there is so much that America and the West in general can learn from how the Chinese operate. You've got a strategic petroleum reserve, or you had one. You need to build it up again. You need to have, and all Western economies, Europe is talking about doing the same thing. You need to have strategic reserves of all these key minerals and all these key commodities, all these key goods, as much as they can be stockpiled, should be there to try and moderate some of the volatility that we see in markets. Now, will markets like that? No, markets like big volatility, big on the upside, big on the downside. Society doesn't like that. The economy doesn't like that. Voters don't like that. They want stability so you can plan your business. And I genuinely think there are so many leaves that we could take out of China's book that would be for our benefit. But if we were, and this is my parting thought, if we were, unfortunately, that will only increase global tension because you're mirroring China's policy back at it. And it's a policy that works well for them. It would be more difficult globally if other people were to try and mirror it back, which we will.
It's a good, very good point. But and then when we start our next one, it'll be with the debt situation, because the debt situation, and the debt situation, I would argue, is far worse than the United States. Well, especially in terms of public debt, the private debt situation, it's a little bit different.
I have to throw this in as well, then. I'm sorry, because I don't know how many months it'll be to the next one. Just a teaser, right? So, Ira, what's China's fiscal deficit on an annual basis?
As a percentage of GDP?
Percentage of GDP.
What, I think about 42-43%.
On an annual basis? No, not debt. Fiscal deficit on an annual basis.
What's the physical? You know, I don't know what the annual physical debt, because I never trust those numbers that I see anyway. Okay.
So the broadest estimate from the people who I respect the most is 15% of GDP annually. 15. Is 15. Yeah, so double the U.S.
Yeah, is that double the U.S. That's including the regions, though, right? Because they
but they're always going to come under the central umbrella.
Okay, you know, all right, yeah. That's, okay.
So double the U.S. What's China's full state, including the regions, debt to GDP ratio? If you really do the deep digging, have a guess. What do you think it is?
I don't know. I thought if you know on a just the debt to GDP was in the 40 something percent. But when you
it's the same as the US. It's around 100, 120, something like that. It's the same as the US. So they've got a debt level that's the same if you count everything, contingent liabilities, which will be triggered at some point, et cetera. Right. And they've got a fiscal deficit that's twice the size. And yet we're talking about a currency here that could move up, that could move down. They can carry that because of capital controls. And because they produce so much, they run a trade surplus with the rest of the world. If you run a trade surplus with the rest of the world, you have a firewall That means, you know, we've got more money coming in than going out. We can pretty much inflate or deflate wherever we think is fit to a degree alongside capital controls. And so part of what I think the US will have to do going forward, again, is mirroring that policy back. And that's where you are going to see, I think, Trump's leading the way. Don't be surprised if the Democrats don't follow eventually. And saying, you know what, we need to narrow this trade deficit. We need to do everything we can to narrow it because it makes the government debt easier to carry.
Yeah, well, that's a fact, and that's where it really leaves us off. But yet, the Chinese bonds have performed unbelievably good. Now you could say, well, it's all this forced domestic purchase, you know, because first of all, their savings pool is so enormous, which you have to take into consideration too. But that's, you know, because they probably save what, 35%. What's the number? I mean, it's gigantic. Where the U.S. saves 3%, but as the world's reserve currency, you, as your Scott Disdain would say, have an exorbitant privilege that you utilize. But the Chinese savings pool is enormous, which makes Japan so far different than the United States too. So when people say, well, you know.
But remember, it isn't household saving. It's not households being prudent individually. It's forced saving through financial repression, where basically money that would otherwise go to households is redirected towards production instead. That's how China does it. But the way you do that, you know, is with tariffs. Effectively, in the US, you spend less and you end up raising revenue, and then you attempt to try and redirect towards production rather than consumption. So there are ways to do it. I'm not saying they'll happen. I'm not saying they wouldn't have side effects. Goodness me, they'll have side effects. There would be, you know, serious inflation for quite some time. But the point being, when we start talking about issues like the debt, there are many different multidimensional ways to address it. And some of them could produce some really surprising outcomes for macro and for markets.
Yep. And that's what we'll get to as investors. But, you know, and again, if the dollar is weak, you know, going back to the investment scenario, I think it'll, in the short term, it'll sustain global equity markets because it'll look like credit restraints are loosening around the world, but it won't be sustained, you know. But again, steepening yield curves are in the short term effect benefit for a positive for equity markets until you get to the break point.
I think that's the key point on all of this, until we get to the break point, and we agree there are lots of break points.
Yeah, and with all the intervention as we started this discussion with from all the global central banks, we don't know where that is anymore. We never knew exactly where it was, but we know far less than we've ever known, because the dynamics over the last 4 or 5, actually over the last 12, 13 years have changed dramatically.
Well, they have. And by the way, in terms of we know less than we've ever known, just to bring it back to one point we started with, I think we're wrapping up fairly soon, I guess, from what Richard was saying. Talk about the BOJ. How annoyed are you if your Governor Ueda, couldn't the Fed have given him a call and said, we're going to pivot in a couple of weeks? I mean, do you think they didn't? And also the RBA, I don't think they get the same international attention. The RBA governor, who should have hyped more in the year, our RBA analyst who's doing a great job, Ben Picton, earlier in the year, he expected them to be doing more hiking than they did, but they're worried about their housing market, as they always are. So didn't. And now inflation is still pretty strong in the system, and she's having to come out and say, well, we can't cut. We may have to hike again, and we can't cut, as everyone else is. And then the Fed immediately turns around and pivots. And you would think the Fed might, at Jackson Hole, have just sent out a group send email ahead of time, or a couple of weeks ahead of time, to the BOJ. No need to hike, because we're going to cut, you know, or to the RBA. Don't worry about it. It's all good. But you wonder, is there any communication going on?
Yeah, it is a big wonder for me. I having been in this and done this for so many years, and I've seen coordinate, you know, yes, the plaza, you know, but I've seen other things. 1998, China and the United States coordinated an intervention on the yen because the yen was too weak and the Chinese were screaming. Bill Clinton was on his way to Beijing. Okay, we just don't, you know, I'm not sure how they communicate anymore. Yellen goes to China, and the day she comes home, it's like the policy that has come out. Now they're talking, you know, they go, well, we're talking, we're meeting, and she admonishes the Chinese, you need to cut your production. And then a day later, they're throwing up tariffs and threatening other things. I go, well, what was this all about? What's the coordination here? You say that you're talking and you're coordinating. Yeah. I just don't see it. And then of course, you know, if we go to Jake Sullivan, well, Jake Sullivan's in China as we're talking.
Oh, please, please.
But and for what purpose, I don't know. But we go back to April of 2023, when Sullivan at Brookings laid out the Biden doctrine of, you know, the new industrial policy, right? With the small yard with the high fence.
And what have they done with that? I mean, that, by the way, that's part of the economic philosophy I was saying needed to have some spelling right. out. The Fed should have been part of it. How is the Fed not part of that? Insane. But I think part of the problem, whether it's communication with the BOJ or with the RBA or with the markets and between the US and China, I agree with your consternation. There was a really good tweet by the time this goes out a few days ago, but yesterday from Matthew Pines and another one from David Goldman. And they're talking about, respectively, the conversations they're having with people in top DC law firms about their staff, their new staff coming through, who they were saying, all the Ivy League grads actually can't do anything anymore, nothing. You know, they can sit there and expect a pay rise, but they don't know how to work. Mm-hmm. That was Matthew Pines. And David Goldman was saying, if you look at the people running the State Department, so, you know, the senior civil servants running people like Brookings, most US think tanks, the whole Acela corridor, the DC crowd, they are absolutely the kind of people I was writing about in the Powell of the Powerless, who live in their own fantasy world. They are just as bad, even though they think they're realists and they think they get it. They're just as bad as when you had Dick Cheney saying under George Bush, saying, George W. Saying we create our own reality when we act. Do you remember that arrogance when the US was the unipower? I mean, but they have the same idiot mindset with a much, much weaker US and a much, much weaker economy, a much, much stronger and more worldly and realpolitik counterparties on the other side. And yet, you know, if you live in a DC bubble, you probably still think you're the center of the universe. You're not. You're absolutely not.
No, I can't agree with you more. I've been very critical of Dalip Singh, who put together the sanctions on Russia. I thought that was, you know, when he was on 60 Minutes. I know I don't watch that stuff, but I got 20 emails about it. And I said, he reminds me of Robert McNamara in his arrogance. Mm. That's what I thought. That's what I thought. And now they brought him back into the White House. We don't hear, but he left PGIM, which I thought was interesting to go back to the White House. But that's a whole different conversation.
Well. That's the revolving door. I agree. But in terms of the sanctions, that when Russia invaded Ukraine, which I believe, and anyone watching can correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll completely say mea culpa, I believe I was the only analyst who put a piece out a month in advance of it saying the market was severely underpricing, as in nudge, nudge, wink, wink, the risk that Russia would invade, because everyone else was living in their own fantasy reality where war doesn't happen anymore, not in mainland Europe. And I said, no, I think it will. And we said, look, if it does happen, the effects will be X, Y, Z. We got some right. We got some a bit wrong because you don't call everything right, but generally we got it right. But above and beyond that, we then said if sanctions get put in place on Russia, they would have to be sanctions, which are secondary sanctions against everybody else like China, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, including Germany, by the way, who's selling everything through Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. So, but we said if they do that, then it's almost impossible to actually compute what the impact is going to be because you break the entire global economy into pieces because the others will push back and you fragment everything. And as a result, they're not going to work anywhere near as well as one would like. You know, we can estimate they'll be like this, but they can't work unless you put secondary sanctions on. And what are we doing? Playing around with secondary sanctions because we know that it will break the global economy. That was obvious from day one.
All right. Well, I know this has gone long and you didn't get, Richard, you didn't get any real trade ideas, but everybody is on notice. And when is the timing of this going to, as Michael talks about, you don't hold me to timing because I'm a trader. And if you're right at the wrong time, you're wrong, but you do get a view as to how you have to start adjusting your portfolio. When you start to see, I mean, the whole thing with the dollar right now is a major thing that you have to pay attention to, because the interest rate differential still exists. In fact, as Michael talks about, the U.S. is the only one who hasn't moved their rates officially, and yet it's their currency that has suffered the most. So all the tells in the game are switching. Pay attention. Where are they going to go? I have an idea where they're going to end. What's the timeline? Forget about it. That's stupid. I'm not. But I will be watching these things to see, because when you see long-held correlations start to break down, sit up and pay attention, because you better start adjusting your portfolio. That's all. Correct. If you take that out of this, you take it all out.
Words of wisdom from Ira and Michael. It's been a fascinating discussion, multidimensional analysis. How can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work, Michael?
Well, all my work is obviously for Rabo clients. You can look me up on LinkedIn, Michael Every at Rabobank. And I'm also on X at The Michael Every. A bit arrogant, but I couldn't get a shorter handle that would fit with my name. So The Michael Every.
Okay. And Ira. Yeah.
I'm here. And I will tell everybody, you should subscribe to Rabobank's research. It's some of those pieces are just today's or yesterday's was a classic, but I'm here at FRA and I try to jump around. I'm not writing much to my chagrin, because I liked the interplay when I would write, and Notes from Underground for 14 years was really, I just had such enjoyment in the interaction with really high powered thinkers like Michael. You know, when I go back and I read from the archives, the interchanges that went on, they were really good. But I'm here with you, Richard. So whenever you ring my bell and say, okay, we've got somebody who wants to have a discussion, and share these with your friends and family, because I think there's a lot of wisdom to follow out here and how to proceed to, you know, it's not always about how much you make. A lot of times it's how much you can protect of your wealth and be attentive to it.
Great. Thank you very much, Michael and Ira.
Thanks, Mike.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.